Hello once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me here on this Tuesday, September 25th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour and 10, hour and 15 minutes or so. Let's go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Glad to have you with me for this Tuesday edition of the show. Two guests will join me. The first, Brian Blessing, the host of Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Hotline. We're going to chat a little bit about NFL Week 4, then spend the majority of our segment today on the Ryder Cup over in Paris at Le Golf National. A big-time tournament, lots of fun, lots of emotion. Should be a good time watching that, and, of course, good to handicap as well. Second half of today's show, Rolf Michaels, professional handicapper over at WagerTalk.com, joins us. We'll chat NFL Week 4 and College Football Week 5 with him. Got five games per listener request that we're going to talk about, and then he'll also give out his top situational and technical plays for Week 5 at the end of that segment. Over at BangTheBook.com, we are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. Tons of great content over there. My updated college football power ratings were posted yesterday. Also, the opening line report for both college football and the NFL. This morning here, I posted my Super Contest recap for Week 3. 3-2 for both of our traditional entries. 2-3 for our gold entries. So we came into Week 3 tied for first place. We're a point and a half off the pace now after Week 3, but you can read all about that over at bangthebook.com. My daily MLB picks and tips piece updated. Few games I like here today, a lot more than yesterday's card, so go and check that out. Also, we've got a Ryder Cup preview that I wrote. We'll have NFL and college football stuff throughout the week. NBA and NHL team previews are being posted. We've got it all over at bangthebook.com, including our free pick contests, sportsbook reviews, and of course, as you know, this and every edition of Bang the Book Radio presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook, where you can use that promo code BANG100 to get a 100% deposit bonus at BetDSI, where it's only a game until you bet it. Two guests on the program here today. The first, Brian Blessing, the host of Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Hotline. Brian, how's it going today, man?
Oh, I'm good, Adam. Just mid-season form now. I'm getting into a crazy rhythm with the college football, the NFL, and out here it's close now. Hockey's about to start.
Yes, sir. And I guess
big news. Shea Theodore signed a 7-year deal last night, which is a big deal for the Golden Knights.
Yeah, it definitely is. Good for them to be securing some of that core group. And of course, that was one of the questions we kind of had about Vegas, is how they would set this thing up. You know, with the expansion draft, with a lot of the trades that they made, with some of the agreements that they came to with teams not to take certain players, good to see them locking up that core a little bit here. I guess before we do NFL and Ryder Cup, Brian, real quickly, are you still having success with those NHL preseason wagers?
Actually, a lot of good fortune with that. Again, you just check those rosters. Although I will say this to you last night, Colorado, it sure seemed like they set a makeshift lineup into Vegas, and Vegas hadn't lost a preseason game. They walked in here and rolled. So I think those things that we had talked about in preseason, that ship has kind of sailed. We're now to the home stretch, and I think the final two, three games, specifically the final two games, I think you'll see starting goaltenders and pretty much the teams that are going to come out of the gate and be starting are going to get after it. So I think that the preseason fun might be over here as these guys really get ready for the real stuff, which is a week away.
Well, and that's a real good point for our listeners out there because, you know, there's no shame in getting your money and getting out. You know, if you find an angle that really works for you, I know a lot of people do this with spring training baseball, for example. Those lines tend to move quite a bit. But if you find that there's some value in something and that value starts to go away, don't force it. Take your profit, be happy with it, move on to something else. And of course, you know, with everything that's going on here at this time of the year, Brian, plenty of different markets for people to invest in, including the NFL. So we'll go ahead and chat some NFL here today with a look at Week 4. And, you know, we'll start with the Thursday night game here, Brian, between the Minnesota Vikings and the LA Rams. Game 101-102 on the board. Minnesota, 6.5-point underdog here for the short week and long travel out to the West Coast. Brian, I have to ask you, I'm sure you followed along with that Minnesota-Buffalo game. Was that just a bad spot for Minnesota coming off of that game against Green Bay? Were they just overlooking the Bills? Or did you see some more concerning things for the Vikings?
Well, you know, that was a game that we had talked about on the podcast last week, Adam. And he said, you know, if people are believers in such things, going into that game last week, it was one of the definition of a sandwich game. They had played five quarters against their blood rival, and then had Buffalo coming in, just been horrible through two games, and they had the Rams in the on deck circle with a short week, to the point where they'll never admit it, but I they're already working on installing stuff for the Rams. I'll guarantee it. And listen, they're professional football players. And the other thing I would say is we had talked about it was a unique preseason in that a lot of teams had not played their guys. And I think you're still trying to find out, who some of these teams are. And the overreactions in the market in the last 2 years is unlike anything we've ever seen in the NFL, where numbers sway week to week. The concern for the Vikings, they just didn't show up. I mean, Buffalo punched them in the mouth. And the game wasn't as close as the final score. Buffalo called the dogs off in the second half. I mean, Buffalo played the clock in the second half. They just ran the ball, punted, and Minnesota couldn't do a thing against them. The kid Josh Allen played really good. Okay, that's Buffalo's side of things. But Cousins was just terrorized. And so that would be concerning, absolutely. On a short week, going to play the Rams, if Donald and this Rams defense, which I think is the hidden nugget there, everybody's all, oh, boy, look what Goff's doing, and Gurley's a monster, and, Cook stretches the field, and Woods is really an interesting wide receiver. He's a hybrid. I mean, he can get deep. He can be a possession guy. He can run the slants. And then Kupp is now the kind of the Edelman kind of guy who's very dangerous. So that offense is really good for the Rams. Their defense that is really kind of the hidden nugget on that football team, Adam. And they've been, I think, by far and away, I think you made a case that the Chiefs, have been this highlight reel. But the Rams, boat racing the Raiders, the Cardinals, and then, handling the Chargers pretty easily have been really impressive. Now, you can sit there and say, who have they played so far? That would be the one thing you'd shoot a hole at the Rams if you were looking to shoot a hole at them. But it's a tough spot for Minnesota. It's another tough spot, bud. The one thing they got going for them is professional pride. And the Bills show that. These guys are pros. I mean, they get embarrassed. They fight back.
Well, and this was a line over the summertime that was Rams -3. So we have seen an adjustment here based on how these two teams have played. And look, from a Minnesota standpoint, they were outplayed in week one by San Francisco. They had the pick six that allowed them to cover that game. 49ers went up to Minnesota and played very, very well in that game. Then they blow that fourth quarter lead against Green Bay. That's tough to come back from. Don't play very well against the Buffalo Bills. Maybe Minnesota's just not that good of a team. And it's kind of strange to say that because, they were a team expected to be a Super Bowl contender here. Maybe they're just not that good of a team. Maybe it's taking time with Kirk Cousins. Maybe we see some more Dalvin Cook here this week. Maybe Minnesota is just regressing a little bit. The Rams, on the other hand, last week I loved the Chargers. I thought the Chargers were probably my favorite play of the first 3 weeks of the NFL season. The Rams win that game, cover with relative ease in that spot as well. And that was the thing for the Rams, was up until that game last week against the Chargers, they hadn't played anybody. They beat up on a pretty bad Oakland team in the second half, shut out a terrible Cardinals team. They hadn't played anyone. Then they answered the bell, played a good game against the Chargers there. So, I don't know. I mean, I wish this game was on Sunday, so this was a more accurate representation of these two teams, because this travel spot for Minnesota is a very brutal one, to say the least. But I can't help but think that, honestly, based on the body of work that we've seen so far, and yeah, there's a little bit of reactionary adjustment to this number, I don't think this number is off that much.
No. I would say to you, and it wouldn't necessarily be a game I'd be playing, but to me it'd be the Rams or nothing. But, it's 6.5 before it got to 7. I would throw it back at you, Adam. I mean, listen, I think it's still a good team. I don't know that I was ever that sold on Kirk Cousins all those, those years with the Redskins. It's a bizarre analogy, they're completely different style of players. I'm more saying this about like kind of the results. I almost compare Kirk Cousins kind of to a Tyrod Taylor, that he's going to look really good and they're going to go out. They're going to be games where they play really good and they roll you. But I just don't have faith in this guy, you know, in a close game to take you down the field and win a close game. That's my thing with him. And he might be this era's new Dave Craig because he fumbles the ball a lot. So if you get in his face and his grill early on, you know, you listen, Thielen and Diggs, they've got weapons and Cooks. I'm not a huge Kirk Cousins guy.
I go back and forth on Cousins, but the one thing I will say here is that I think we need to start paying attention a little bit more to how these offensive coordinators and head coaches elevate quarterbacks. You know, Jared Goff, granted, it was his rookie year, but in his rookie year, he looked nothing like the player that he is now. And I think you have to give Sean McVay a lot of credit for that. I mean, the talent was there. He was a high first-round pick, as we all know. But Sean McVay plays into his skill set so well. When you look at what Washington is already doing with Alex Smith, you know, I mean, Alex Smith has always been a solid quarterback, but he looks the part of being maybe a top 10, top 12 starter in the NFL now with Washington. I think we have to give Jay Gruden a lot of credit for that. It almost feels like we could start making that argument here with Kirk Cousins that, you know, maybe Jay Gruden just elevated him a little bit more than his talent level. Maybe John DeFilippo, who, you know, was kind of a hot coaching commodity a few years ago when he was the quarterback's coach for the Browns, maybe he just doesn't have what it takes here to keep Cousins at that level or even get Cousins above that level. You know, you think about Cincinnati, for example, with Andy Dalton and offensive coordinator Bill Lazor. Andy Dalton over the last 17 games has been absolutely phenomenal as a quarterback. And prior to that, everyone laughed at Andy Dalton. He was the butt of a lot of jokes. Now all of a sudden, he is a top 10 quarterback in the NFL, maybe borderline top 8 type of guy. The offensive coordinator knows what he's working with. There's a good familiarity there. You know, he was his quarterback's coach for a while. So I think that we need to start looking at that relationship more between the OC or the head coach, if it's an offensive-minded guy, and the quarterback. Look at the Miami Dolphins. Adam Gase finally has everything he wants in place. All of a sudden, the Dolphins look like a pretty good offensive team. I think maybe that's the case here in Minnesota, where maybe John DeFilippo is just not ready to elevate a guy like Kirk Cousins, who may just be a marginal quarterback.
You kind of stole my thunder a little bit, because that's what I was going to say, that we don't talk enough about coordinators, even quarterback coaches, or if you're a head coach like Frank Reich, who's a former quarterback, and that relationship that he can have with an Andrew Luck, the coordinators matter so much. You know, I right off the bat, I would tell you, as head coaches, it didn't work. But I wouldn't bat an eye and say to you that I think the two best defensive coordinators in the NFL right now are Jim Schwartz in Philadelphia and Greg Williams in Cleveland. The coordinators matter. They matter big time. And to the point where I've also said this, when you're trying to find chinks in the armor, I've always said this, Adam. You know, if you listen to coach speak, right, at first it was always run and stop the run. Well, now it's a passing game. The teams that are successful can still run the football and they can still stop. There's never been, what's the other thing the coaches say? You know, offense, defense, special teams. Defense, you know, special teams is a third of the game. Well, there is no number in the wagering line for special teams. If a team is in the top 5, 6, 7 in special teams, they're always pinning the team inside the 10, or they're, you know, getting 17 yards of return, and they're constantly winning the field position battle, that leads to victories. There is no number that's taken into account for special teams. And the other thing that they just don't take into account are the coaches. How is there not a number based on a coach? I mean, if you're sitting there, if I get a game, like, and I don't recommend this, I will say don't bet the game just because it's the game that's on TV. But if you're sitting there and you're swaying one way or the other, to me, the coach should be the determining factor. Who am I more comfortable with in terms of this guy knows what he's doing, and, oh, by the way, game management. You know, you're not going to take an idiot timeout on 3rd and 17. You know, you need that timeout at the end of the game. You know, take the 5-yard penalty and punt the ball. Instead, the same guys take a timeout on 3rd and 17, and then at the end of the game, three times a year, they're sitting there where they had a chance to get the ball back to a tie or win the game, and they don't have a timeout because they burned it on a 3rd and 17 early in the third quarter. There's no number on coaches. I've never understood that.
One more NFL game I want to chat about here with you this week, Brian. Game 251-252, first one on the board for Sunday. Miami takes on New England. England's still a 7-point favorite here in this spot, even though they didn't look good in the spotlight on Sunday Night Football. Specifically, Tom Brady didn't look good. Back-to-back losses here for New England. They are 6-0 in their last six games following back-to-back losses, which isn't really a big surprise. But this Miami team here, they're 3-0. They're 4-7 already. They're throwing some water on Miami, and I certainly understand that. They do look like a team in line for a little bit of regression. The opposition has had more first downs in all three Miami games here so far. What do you think about this number of 7, Brian?
I think it's the situation that they're coming off back-to-back losses. Miami's exceeded expectations. It's a big number. The funny thing is, you know, Miami, Tannehill's protecting the football. That's the starting point. That's a good thing for Miami. It's a division game. There is familiarity. Josh Gordon likely shows up this week. What impact he'll have, if it gives them a bounce in their step, we shall see. It's funny, Adam, whenever we see New England have starts like this, everybody goes to, is this the end? Is this and what do? They turn it around, and they're going to be there at the end. I think there are chinks in the armor to a degree, but I also think the personnel they have, albeit they have nothing. Well, Belichick, and they'll work this out. All right, so I'm not going to sit here and pull a violin out and cry for New England or be worried that they won't fix this. It's just, I think if you wanted to find one gray area in there and everybody wanted to pile on Matt Patricia and all the stuff that was going on with the Lions, people are overthinking this. If anybody knew New England's personnel and knew the things and the options that they had on the table, you know, this was a guy that A, had the game circled, but B, dialed something up that could really hurt their cause. I don't think we have to go any further than that. Give Patricia credit for familiarity and dialing something up that really frustrated New England.
And I think when you look at Miami here specifically in this spot, I don't know if I want to fade them this week because I would like to see New England actually look like the Patriots of old, look like the team that we expect. Next week on the road at Cincinnati would be a spot that I have circled to fade the Dolphins. And again, we talked about this on last week's show where you want to always be looking ahead, kind of circling some of those spots, coming back to them when game week rolls around. Miami here on the season, average starting field position, their own 35.4 yard line. Second is the Browns at 32.5. Then the Browns have forced about 900 turnovers so far this year. So the fact that Miami, well ahead of them in that department, you have to expect some regression there. Offense is going to face some longer fields. And as I mentioned, you know, their offense not getting a ton of first downs here so far this year. Some of that a byproduct, of course, of the short fields. But you would expect Miami to regress. I think you circle that game next week on the road at Cincinnati. Back-to-back leads, off a division game. Really hope, I think, and I'm not going to have any investment in this Miami-New England game, you hope that Miami plays well. I don't know if they win, but if they play well, outgain New England, maybe lose by a field goal, something like that, or outright win the game, that's the hope that I have so I can come back and go against them next week against Cincinnati. And that's something you want to pay attention to. Even if you're not going to have any investment on a game specifically, look to use it to your advantage in the future.
Well, there's no doubt. I think you know, the other thing I would say is it's a game you're paying attention to. In the opportunities that exist now that, you know, really weren't there in the past with in-game wagering. Obviously, halftime wagering has been around forever. But, I mean, you can watch a game. You know, if you're going in there with any gray areas, you know, why would you jump into the deep end of the pool unless you had convictions? I mean, this game's hard enough to begin with. But it doesn't mean that's not the kind of game you can sit there and watch and say, oh, the Patriots moved it up and down the field They dropped the touchdown pass in the end zone, settled for a field goal, or fumbled at the 7. They were marching up and down the field. Then you find value in the halftime number that was put up. Or, again, back to the coaches. They missed some tackles. They'll make some adjustments that, you could dive into a game in midstream, a game that you had doubts on. But the eyeball test is still, to me, you could crunch numbers and power rankings, and everybody has their way to do this. But to me, the eyeball test is still the biggest thing out there.
All right, let's transition over to the golf side of things here, because I want to make sure that we've got some time to talk about the Ryder Cup. The 2016 Ryder Cup at Hazeltine was probably the most invested I've been in golf in a very, very long time. It was a great event to watch. Obviously, you had Patrick Reed and Rory McIlroy going back and forth. I'm expecting a very high-energy environment here over in France for the 2018 version at Le Golf National. This is also the site of the Olympics in 2024. So we can do a little bit of handicapping on the course here for that, as we've got 5 rookies on Team Europe, I believe 3 rookies on the U.S. team. This is a match play format. Friday, you've got foursomes and four balls. Four balls would be the better ball. Foursomes would be alternate shot. Same thing on Saturday. 12 individual matches on Sunday. So that's how we'll break down the format here for the Ryder Cup. And Brian, let's start with a look at the course, because this is a situation here where the European team has a distinct advantage over the U.S. team.
Here annually. So the Europeans, the majority of them know this course very, very well. A handful of the Americans played in that event. I think on the course side of things, it's narrow. There's a lot of water, but it's match play. So just generally speaking, the difference here is there are guys that just don't win because they always take a snowman somewhere over 4 days. They have a hole or two that shoots themselves out of a tournament. This is, scratch it off and get on to the next hole. So the guys that can be stars in this kind of format, they aren't necessarily the guys that go out and win tournaments. Justin Rose is number one in the world. That's great. He manages golf courses. He doesn't take himself out of golf tournaments. Well, he's the number one player in the world. Does that mean he's the stud in match play? Not necessarily so. I mean, when he's playing well, he's hitting fairways, he's hitting middle of greens, and he's, taking advantage of the holes that present themselves as birdie opportunities. In this format, on the tough holes, the guy that's aggressive and can flag hunt is the guy, and if he's playing very well, he's the guy that's going to be your star. I mean, the format itself, Adam, is the starting point for the big difference maker.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, also, too, as you're kind of looking at it here, the captains do not have an easy job here in this tournament trying to put together the pairings because, like you said, and especially when you're talking about the team formats with the four ball and the foursome with alternating shots and better balls, you've got some guys that are very, very good scramblers. You've got some guys that are going to be very good players from that thick rough that's on this course, from some of the bunkers that are on this course, guys that can leave it close to the pin, and these are very large greens here for the most part at Le Golf National. But that guy may not be hitting. It may not be his turn to hit that shot, in that foursome format. So that's one of the problems that you run into here as well, is that you kind of need guys to play well off of each other. That is one advantage I think Team USA has. The course is an advantage for the Europeans because they play it every year with the Open de France. Justin Thomas, the only U.S. Ryder Cup player that was in that here this year, you only have 3 rookies for Team USA. You have 5 for Team Europe. So I think you've got a little bit more familiarity with who can play well together on the American side.
And you're not just for the first 2 days, you're sitting there, the pressure of playing for your country, but you're playing for a teammate, and especially an alternate shot. So guys that are on the same page, when one player says to the other, what's your preferred distance? There's one thing. You're sitting there, you want to lay up to a certain distance, a dialed-in distance. Well, you're not playing your game. And now you're hitting a shot. To this guy, normally on a par 5, the guy wants to lay up his number is 87 yards. You know, that's his gap wedge. That's the distance he loves. Well, the guy he's playing with, he wants to hit it 106. That's his, you know, I mean, so that the communication, there's so many little idiosyncrasies. It says, let's hit it and hope, and then, you know, it's the next guy's problem. And communication's a big thing. You know, there are things that have stood the test of time. Tiger Woods and Mickelson have losing records in the Ryder Cup, thrive in the format. You know, I'm sitting there, there's so many offerings that are out there. 10-1, Ian Poulter, Justin Rose is plus 450 to be the top point getter for the European side. Well, what did we just say a couple minutes ago? I don't, you know, yeah, he's a great player. Yeah, he may play great, he may be spectacular, but in his format, I think it's the great equalizer. Well, Ian Poulter lives for this. Ian Poulter thrives on this. I'd be playing Ian Poulter at 10-1 to be the top point getter for the European side. It's not a standard golf tournament. I mean, the WGC match play events, one of my absolute favorite events of the year, because you can watch them play the first day, and then you know who's in good form, when bad numbers are being put up. Yeah, this guy won his match 3-2. Well, he had three shots that should have gone out of bounds. They hit a tree trunk and came back in bounds, and the guy won, but he was lucky. He wasn't hitting it that good. I come back to the eyeball test, Adam, and that's the beauty of the Ryder Cup, is to watch these guys in those first couple of days, and then Sunday's the day you can really come out of the gate when they get back into playing their own ball. But who was playing well in the first 2 days?
Well, of course, one of the hard parts about this tournament here, with it being in France, is that coverage starts in Eastern time zone 2 a.m., 11 p.m. out west. So watching this may be a little bit of a challenge for some people out there. Fortunately, it is Friday, Saturday, Sunday, so you can catch up on sleep next weekend or something like that. Ian Poulter, who you mentioned, 12-4-2 in his matches here in the Ryder Cup. That's the best record of anybody. Justin Rose, 11-6-2. Sergio Garcia, 19-11-7. That is one of the differences here, where the U.S. team only has three rookies in Justin Thomas, Bryson DeChambeau, Tony Finau, but there's a lot more experience on the European side. Five rookies, but the other seven players, 124 combined matches of Ryder Cup experience. So, you know, this is such an interesting tournament. Patrick Reed last year, absolutely phenomenal for the Americans in his second Ryder Cup. He's 6-1-2 in his matches. But the overall leading scorer in 2016 at Hazeltine was rookie Thomas Peters, who's not even on the European Ryder Cup team here this year. So, you know, experience, not necessarily everything here in this event. So you mentioned Ian Poulter is a guy that you like for Team Europe, Brian. Who are you looking at here as the top scorer for the American side?
I think Ricky Fowler's not insane, because, you know, he fares well when he plays over in Europe, and he goes over there usually as a prelude to the British Open. So I think Ricky Fowler would be interesting. I'm almost convinced this will happen, and we'll see. I think John Rahm is going to be a really interesting guy for the European side. He's this fiery lunatic who plays great. I can see him pairing him with Rory McIlroy. And then on the other side, you've got the Reed-Spieth combination. And if I'm really hoping that they do this. It would be great entertainment. We had the Reed-McIlroy match 2 years ago, which was amazing. I can see Reed and Spieth going against McIlroy and Rahm. And that would be pretty fiery. That would be some fireworks. That'd be good stuff. And don't sleep on another guy that absolutely has had shining moments, and had he not won the Masters, we'd be talking about the highlights of his career, Sergio Garcia, who plays very, very well in the Ryder Cup. And Phil Mickelson's going to be – the other thing, there's so much – I mean, and we could do 2 hours on this. You know, talking about current form coming in. Well, Brooks Koepka and Phil Mickelson were a train wreck at East Lake. But again, it's not a stroke event. No, you have a bad hole, put it behind you. But Furyk's got to now judge the current form of these two guys, and you're massaging egos. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if Mickelson plays the first day. I really don't. And then, you know, you got to keep him content and happy. And remember, Mickelson was a polarizing loudmouth when Tom Watson was the captain and they lost. And that was one of the low moments in his career. I mean, a lot of guys said, he just called out Tom Watson. And, I give him full marks for being vocal and speaking his mind. But in this kind of thing, there's got to be camaraderie and that sense of team. The advantage the Americans have, obviously, a draw keeps them the cup. But I don't know about the number, but I'm looking at this European side. I don't know how's the USA favored like this. I just don't get it. I mean, Casey Fleetwood, Sergio, Catton's another volatile guy. McIlroy, Molinari played great in North America this year. Norrin had chances to win this year. Olsen's a good player. John Rahm, Justin Rosen, your captain picks are Stenson and Poulter, and they've got 65,000 people screaming and yelling, and they know the course. How's the U.S. I know part of it is that a draw keeps the cup, so that's math. I just think the number's inflated here on the U.S. side. I really do.
Yeah, the U.S. to win about minus 140, Europe to win about plus 160. I think the primary component to this is that the U.S. team has 9 of the top 15 in the official world golf rankings. So this is a loaded USA roster. But again, those are all stroke play events, and it is a different type of animal here when it comes to match play. One other thing I'll point out here with regards to, trying to figure out the top point scorer and things like that, Ricky Fowler didn't play in the four-ball matches last year. So you want to make sure that you're picking a guy that does end up playing in everything. Now, I think on this team, with how Fowler has played over the last 2 years, he should be in both of those four-ball matchups, so I think he's a decent look. I also like Justin Thomas a lot in this event. He is a Ryder Cup rookie, but played in the President's Cup last year. We know he's one of the top players in the world. I don't think this match play format phases him too much. Probably going to be paired with Ricky Fowler in those foursomes. So I think Justin Thomas plus 650 or so to be the top U.S. point scorer would be my favorite play of the thing. But again, Brian, the last point we'll leave off with here with regards to the Ryder Cup is, as you said, you can watch on Friday, see who's playing well. I mean, keep in mind, you got a guy like Alex Norrin, who you just mentioned. Alex Norrin won this Open de France during the European Tour calendar this year. He's a Ryder Cup rookie, but he won on this course already this year. So you can watch the first day, get an idea, and of course, with this match play format, lots and lots of matchups in play here, a lot of angles to attack this tournament.
I'd even throw one more at you, and I don't have the price in front of me. I don't know if you've got it. I forgive me on this, but this just popped in my head while we're talking. I'm saying, Poulter's low-hanging fruit, right? I mean, we know about Poulter. Guy's had an incredible couple of years. I would be shocked if Thomas Bjorn doesn't pair Ian Poulter with Tommy Fleetwood. I think that would be a great pairing for the European side, have the two Brits playing together. And Tommy Fleetwood has had just been so consistent for 2 years. And Poulter could kind of, get him that fire you need in this kind of event. And then you get to the singles play on Sunday. Tommy Fleetwood, I think, actually, the more I think about it, is a guy, and a guy I'd be looking to play on in this event.
Tommy Fleetwood, 18-1 overall, 9-1 to be the top point getter for the European team. And I agree with you on pairing him with Poulter. And also, I kind of look at Fleetwood a little bit like Peters last year, where, very, very talented guy, the hype train kind of building up a little bit. A lot of people were tipping Fleetwood in the middle of the PGA Tour season when he was over stateside for the majors and all those types of things. Never really broke through, but this is a guy that has that level of talent. And maybe this is kind of the coming out party for Fleetwood, who, by the way, won the French Open here in 2016. So he's also won on this course. So Brian Blessing, the host of Sportsbook Radio. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just real quick going to say, Adam, and this is about the podcast more than anything. I want to say thanks to the people that are out there. We actually got a lot of Twitter love because our video last week was on the Tour Championship that we did. I've got a Ryder Cup video, but in the video and on the podcast last week, made a case, a very strong case for Tiger Woods, and he cashed, and the beauty of it was got him early at 14-1. That number came down the week leading up to the event. But with a 30 golfers to go against and the way he was driving the ball, and there was an overlaid price there. We had the good fortune to cash a ticket on Tiger Woods, but I got a lot of people that made comments that they religiously listened to your podcast, and they cashed a ticket on Tiger, and we're happy about that. But I just wanted to let you know that, you know, a lot of people on Twitter were stepping up to the plate saying that they had caught the segment we did last week and cashed the ticket. So that's a good feeling. It, honestly, I cashed. I was happy. But it's a good feeling when if you did something and somebody else got something out of it. I was pretty excited about that and got the feedback that a lot of people kind of jumped in and cashed that ticket. So thanks to those that had the nice comments, and glad you were listening.
Yeah, me too. And thanks to you for calling yesterday morning and, you know, kind of talking about that a little bit with me. It meant a lot that, you know, we saw so much positive feedback for that. And, of course, it means a lot to have you on the show here every week as well. Brian Blessing, the host of Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Hotline. How can people find those two shows, Brian?
The shows are live and archived at sportsbookradio.com, kshp.com. There's an app, KSHP Las Vegas. It's noon to two weekdays Pacific time. We get the top sportsbook directors here in Vegas, handicappers, and then Vegas Hockey Hotline. Yesterday we had Dave Gosher, the play-by-play guy for the Golden Knights, on at a remote we did over at the Suncoast. Today Brad May, the color analyst for the Golden Knights, will be on, and we can, you know, some of the big names around the hockey world. A lot of fun. It's 2 fun hours each and every day, Adam, and the shows are archived at sportsbookradio.com, and I put the links up as well on Twitter at Brian Blessing.
And, of course, you can check out Brian's two videos on our YouTube page, one for the Ryder Cup, one for Week 4 of the NFL. At Brian Blessing on Twitter. Brian, we appreciate your time. Thank you so much, man. We'll talk to you again next week.
Hey, Adam, have a great week, pal.
Always fun there with Brian Blessing, again, of Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Hotline. We'll try to put some more Ryder Cup on tomorrow's show as well, excuse me, with Wes Reynolds in that second segment on our Wednesday broadcast. We got one more guest here for this Tuesday edition of the show. That is professional handicapper Ralph Michaels from WagerTalk.com. Ralph, how's it going today, man?
Add me to the list that owe you and Brian Blessing a shout-out. I also cashed on Tiger. I never bet golf before this year, and when I come on Tuesdays now following Brian, you guys get me all psyched up for this week's golf tournaments, and I was fortunate to jump on Tiger for my first-ever golf win.
There you go. That's awesome. Congratulations to you. And I know Brian's still listening here on hold. So, Brian, another happy customer here for your Bang the Book radio segments. Rolf, you know, now that we're in week four of the NFL season, I mean, it's crazy to think that after this week, you know, most of the league, 30 of the league's teams, will have played a quarter of their schedule already. Two teams on bye this week, the Redskins and the Panthers, getting that early week off. But it's crazy to think that. I mean, we're about 25% of the way done already. It feels like it just started.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, we see in the AFC, you know, who would have thought that Miami and Kansas City were the only undefeated teams? And add on top of that, we only have three undefeated teams overall, including the Rams, which I think now, after three games, many people have as the best team in the NFL.
So what do you make of that? What do you make of the fact that we only have three undefeated teams, as you mentioned, Miami, Kansas City, and the Rams? A lot of people down on the Chiefs coming into this season, looking at that defense, saying it's old, it's not very fast. Mahomes is this great unknown. Well, they're 3-0. Miami, you know, big surprise there being 3-0. The Rams, probably not so much, but the manner in which they've done it has been very dominant here. They're already plus 66 in point differential. So what do you make of the fact that we only have three undefeated teams and then even some surprises at 2-1 like Denver, Tennessee, maybe Washington to some degree, the Chicago Bears? What do you make of what we've seen here so far?
Well, you know, you look at Miami first and, you know, being 3-0 isn't that big of a deal when you've played the schedule they've played Tennessee, the Jets, and Oakland. And, you know, all of those lines were between the threes and two of them at home. So, you know, for them, you take what you can. Chicago, I think, you know, people didn't think Trubisky was ready. And, you know, the addition of Mac gave them a lot of emotion. You know, so each situation is different. But, you know, I just think that we've seen a lot of ugly play. I, you know, the penalties have changed the momentum of this game so much. You don't have these teams making the same type of drives. You have so much stop and go in the game that, you know, it's almost like a baseball game now where there's no flow to it. You know, you have a penalty every three or four plays, and it really just takes away from, I think, good offensive teams being good. And I think it gives the defense a lot of edge when they're not getting those penalties for roughing the passer called on them. But, you know, right now, I still think we have more bad teams than we have good teams. And I still think we're going to be very top heavy and bottom heavy come the end of the year.
And it's funny too, because I saw somebody from Pro Football Focus. I can't remember exactly who it was as I was scrolling through Twitter last night, but they had a tweet, and it was partially in jest, I imagine, but they're basically saying, you know, the risk reward of rushing the passer for a sack almost isn't worth it anymore with all the 15-yard flags that are getting called. So you kind of wonder here, as the season goes along, you know, will teams kind of temper that aggressiveness a little bit, play a little bit more zone, play a little bit more bracket coverage? You know, quarterbacks are going to have time to throw. You're going to have maybe the occasional coverage sack or something like that. But you do kind of wonder how teams wind up adjusting here to what is, quite frankly, a ridiculous set of rules. I'm all about player safety. I'm all about, you know, taking care of these guys after their playing days are over, making sure that, you know, there are funds available for medical care, not just physical medical care, but emotional medical care, because we see players committing suicide, players developing addictions, and this is across all sports. But, you know, when you sack a quarterback and it's a, you know, 60 or maybe a 40-60 call that, you know, tackling the guy with your entire body weight is going to be a 15-yarder, teams are going to have to make adjustments at some point.
Well, you know, it goes against the entire concept of the game. You know, first, you're taught to tackle with your heads up, hit with your shoulder, and drive through the guy. I mean, Clay Matthews' sack was one of the most ridiculous ones I've seen called. But, you know, he did exactly – it was a textbook tackle. I'm sure 100 out of 100 executives would tell you that's a textbook tackle. So when you're taught from peewee through now, this is the way to tackle, and all of a sudden this year the rule changes that you can't tackle this way, and I guess you just have to pull the guy down with your arms or, you know, maybe give the quarterback a flag. You know, give him two flags, and if you get both flags, he's down. That way we'll take the hits out of the game. I say that sarcastically, but, you know, that's basically what we're getting to. So, you know, I agree with you. It's, and how many times have we seen a guy get a sack and then grab a quarterback on a around the waist and toss him down, and that gets called as a penalty for excessive violence? So I don't have an answer for it. And, yes, people will change, but I don't think you can change either. I mean, any NFL quarterback who sits back there with time can pick apart any defense. It doesn't matter. You don't have to be Tom Brady. When you have time to sit back there without any pressure to pick apart a defense. So maybe the NFL wants 50 to 45 games, but that's where we're getting to.
Well, and you know, just as an overall assessment here of week 4, you know, we've got a couple of games with very low totals, the Jets in Jacksonville, Seattle and Arizona. A lot of that has more to do with bad offenses than it does the current state of the NFL. Just about every other game, you know, in the mid-40s or higher. You've got Philadelphia and Tennessee a little bit low. Tennessee not scoring any points right now because of quarterback injuries. Detroit and Dallas, you just have a Dallas offense that looks terrible. But every other game, you know, basically 45 or higher out there in the market. And this has been an upward trend over the last 2 years with, you know, the game protecting quarterbacks and skill position guys. But it feels like we're at an even earlier point here this year where – totals numbers just seem so high, and we're seeing mid-50s with regularity now. The weather will kind of slow this down a little bit once we start getting snow and rain and wind and all of that. But I can't remember a season in which we had, you know, so many 50-plus totals already.
Yeah, and there haven't been that many. I mean, you know, 50 is really an anomaly. You know, I did a couple tweets, and, you know, we talked about that, but I'm trying to pull this up as we do it here. And, you know, this year already, the number, excuse me as I'm typing, and for those that don't use the killersports.com free database, you should. You know, this year, from 2017 and 2018, the 2 years, we've had 25 totals of 50 or higher. Of those 25, six have been this year. So 19 all of last year. We already have six of them 3 weeks in, and there's four more this week. So that'll put it to 10 when 25 was all of last season. So clearly we're at pace to go over. Like you said, weather will be a factor, but, you know, for the most part, I would say weather probably, you know, the entire season, weather probably only factors into maybe 10 or 12 games broken out to those last few weeks where you're going to have either significant winds or snowstorms. So even with the weather, we're clearly at a pace to be our highest scoring in a long time.
So as a handicapper and a bettor, Rolf, how do you adjust? I mean, obviously from a total standpoint, you've kind of adjusted your totals projections, but higher scoring games are going to have an impact on sides as well, because a higher scoring environment is going to help the team with the better offense more often than not, which is probably a reason why we've seen a little bit more inflation out there in the marketplace in terms of some of the sides as well. But, you know, how do you adjust? I mean, what are you looking to do? What are you doing differently here this season as a result?
Well, you know, I like being the contrarian. So I like looking at the value when there's the under. You know, we're getting to the point where, you know, your average line is in the 40s and then they make some adjustments. But the adjustments, I think, this week are because teams that have very good defenses, you know, the Jacksonville line and a few others. I think in a few more weeks, we're going to see games where there's two very bad offenses playing each other, yet the total is going to be high because of what they've done the past few weeks. So you get into a pattern, and the NFL lines makers do it. And, you know, if teams tend to go over, they'll tend to inflate the line. So I think you're going to get some value coming up here when you get two bad offenses together where, you know, the line's a few points higher than it should be just because of what's happened the previous few weeks.
All right, let's talk about a couple of games here. And, of course, you know, as luck would have it, we've been talking about high-scoring games, adjusted totals, all that. Then we're going to talk about two of the lower totals on the board. The Jets and Jacksonville, the first game to touch on here, game 261-262. Jacksonville favored by 7.5, pretty much market-wide. 9 is your teaser protection line at 5 dimes. That's not a big surprise. Bookmaker is at 7 with extra juice on Jacksonville. So looks like we've got, you know, maybe a sharper side here with the New York Jets getting over a touchdown in what projects to be a lower scoring game.
You know, I actually was on Jacksonville last week despite their line against Tennessee, and obviously took it on the chin losing outright. Fournette should be back this week. And, you know, obviously they were just a completely different offense without Fournette. I mean, they had 481 yards at home against New England and 166 yards last week and 12 first downs against Tennessee. But I think that this is, you know, watching Sam Darnold against the Browns last week on the road. Yes, he had the Detroit game and no one had film on him. And, you know, you saw against Miami, he came down and scored 12 points. Then at Cleveland, they scored 17 points and only had 268 yards. I think Sam Darnold's in trouble this week against a Jags defense that, you know, still only gave up 233 yards against Tennessee and 15 first downs. They played at the Giants. They play Tom Brady and they play Tennessee. And on the year, they're along 15, 18, and 15 first downs. This is a game where even though the line is low, it's a game that I clearly like the under. The Jets defense has played better than most expect. You know, 339 is their high this year that they allowed to Detroit, and then 257 to Miami and 323 to Cleveland. This is a game where we talk about high scoring and we talk about high totals. And this is one of these games I've talked about with two bad offenses. And you have a rookie making a back-to-back road start against the league's best defense. So I'm an under fan in this game.
What's so interesting about this game, and we talked about this on yesterday's show with Kyle Hunter with regards to adjusting college football power ratings, because you know, right now, if you want to call it parity, you can. If you want to call it inconsistency, you can. There's a lot of Jekyll and Hyde going on in both college football and the NFL. So you're trying to evaluate what these wins mean. You know, the quality of competition has had a lot of variance from a week-to-week standpoint because you've had these upsets where, you know, you look at Minnesota, for example, you figure beating Minnesota, probably a pretty good thing there for Buffalo, but maybe Minnesota's not all that good. You know, we don't really know. For Wisconsin, you know, you lose to BYU, maybe BYU's a little bit better of a team than we thought. We'll talk about BYU against Washington here in this week's game. If Washington wins by 30 points, what does that say about Wisconsin's loss to BYU? So you're constantly evaluating these teams here, and this game is a prime example. The Jets blew out the Lions in week one with extra prep time. Darnold had, you know, an eternity to prep for that game. Then we see Detroit beat New England and make Tom Brady look really bad last week. Jacksonville beats New England. Everyone says, wow, it's a great win for them. That's really awesome. You know, great performance. Bortles was terrific. Then New England lays that big egg. Jacksonville loses at home to Tennessee and looks terrible. So then you start questioning everything you thought you knew about about Jacksonville. So that common theme here throughout college football and the NFL makes this a very difficult time of year and a difficult season already to start handicapping, because I look at this game and say, Sam Darnold, for the first time since week one, has ample prep time for an opponent. It's a great opponent. It's a top five defense in Jacksonville, but he played back-to-back short weeks coming off of the Monday nighter against Detroit and then, of course, playing the Thursday night game against Cleveland. Maybe he's in better shape here. Maybe this is a better situation for him. But then, as you mentioned here, with this Jacksonville team, you know, great defense, low-scoring game. How many points do the Jets need to score to cover? This is a very complex game, and it's really a complex time in the NFL as we have, you know, such a dichotomy of results thus far.
Yeah, well, you know, clearly, I think it would be a general consensus that Arizona is the worst team, you know, especially after a few weeks. We've seen what they've done. The most shocking stat to me, there's two teams that when I look at their yards per game diff, and you know, I'll start starting next week. I do a chart and I list offenses and defenses, and I just use the numbers because the NFL is such a league of equality. So, you know, I start ranking the offenses and defenses the teams played, but I don't rank the first 4 weeks. I wait to the fourth week and then I backtrack those numbers. That way it's a little more accurate of what you're going to get. Now, while Arizona is minus 202 yards per game, you know, granted that is a incredibly high number. The team, the next worst team in the NFL this year, New England, is minus 106 yards per game. The fourth worst team, Kansas City, is minus 76 yards per game. Their defense is just horrific. Mahomes has got them there, but KC is a team, you know, we're not going to talk about that I look to clearly fade, just having a historic bad defense. And I don't know if there's ever been an NFL team undefeated that is minus 75 yards per game in play after 3 weeks. And again, New England, who some people still have as the NFL's best team, second worst in all of football, minus 106 yards per game.
All right, let's go to game 269-270 here. Cleveland makes the long trip out to Oakland. Cleveland with extra prep time, probably a good thing here with rookie starting quarterback Baker Mayfield, who the second he came into that game, you know, and I wasn't at the game, I was actually over at a buddy's house watching it, but the second he came into that game, that stadium completely changed, had some friends that were there. They were talking about the atmosphere and the environment and just how absolutely bonkers it was. Mayfield went out there and threw dimes. I mean, he was throwing balls so hard that Jets defenders couldn't pick him off. He had a couple of drops where he just threw it so hard guys didn't get it. You know, it's one of those things where kind of the perceived velocity and the actual velocity difference between him and Tyrod Taylor just dramatically different. So the Browns open a pick 'em here against an Oakland team that is winless. Oakland's a good second half fade. They're 0-3 in the second half here so far this season. But last week, a tough travel spot. Overall, played relatively well against Miami. Now they're back home, and this has been a one-sided money train in the betting market. Oakland a 2.5, 3-point favorite market-wide. Pretty clear who the sharp side is thus far, but be interesting to see if we get any buyback as we get closer to kickoff.
Well, I mean, look, Oakland has played. I mean, you want to talk about strength of schedule. Oakland has played the toughest schedule in the NFL. And Oakland has had a halftime lead in all three games. That just means you have to finish. That shows that you played the toughest schedule in the NFL and you can compete with these people. Yes, things happen in the second half. Yes, they blew leads. But on paper, that's a solid team. You know, I look at this Cleveland team. They've played the number 19 schedule, by the way. And they've had 23 straight games away from home where they've lost. And I say it in college and I say it in the NFL. A team needs to learn how to win on the road before they cover on the road. And I think this is clearly that situation with Cleveland. Baker Mayfield making his first start. Baker Mayfield making his first start on the road. Entirely different scenario. Coming in with a home crowd rallying you is one thing. Let's see what happens on the road. I think Cleveland's a greatly improved team. I think Baker Mayfield was light years ahead of Sam Darnold last week. Those passes he made, I don't think he made one bad pass. Every pass was where it should be. I mean, and through some incredible windows. But, you know, here's a stat that surprised me. You know, I looked it up. Thursday night home teams off a win that travel on the road the next week, like Cleveland, since 2000, 5-16 against the spread. And by the way, 15-6 to the over. So again, you would think extra rest, you're off a home motivating win. Now you go on the road. But again, I mean, numbers show you in the NFL, it's been a negative. Again, 5-16 against the spread. To me, I'm a Cleveland fan in heart. I think when I look at these two teams, I have them even as far as my power ratings go. I think Baker Mayfield is an incredible talent. But again, 23 straight losses away from home, I cannot back Cleveland until they do show me that win. I'd rather leave a loser. I'd rather leave a winner off the board than put a loser on and save that 10%. When the Browns prove to me they can win on the road, I'll then start backing them in the right situations.
I'm still shell-shocked by that 5-16 ATS record for a team that wins at home on a Thursday night, then goes out on the road. That is an incredible stat because, as you mentioned, you know, we all think about the extra. I think one thing that kind of comes into play here with this, I'm a big believer in the circadian rhythm. I'm a big believer in the body clock. And when you talk about professional athletes, and I mentioned this before here on the show, and the reason why situational angles can work so well is that these guys have routines. They get accustomed to, you know, the day after the game on Sunday night, you go home, you ice up, everything like that. Monday is kind of a recovery day. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, back to practice. Friday, you generally leave for where you're going. By the way, Denver deciding to leave on Saturdays now this year. That was a big thing that was on Pro Football Talk last week for their game in Baltimore. So keep an eye on those travel situations. Those can be pretty important to look at. But, you know, you leave Friday night, get into town, you have all day Saturday, you do a walkthrough, all that type of thing. But when you play that Thursday night game, what do you do for a couple days? You know, maybe you do start game planning for the next opponent. Maybe you rest up a little bit with the things that are hurting you, the things that are ailing you. But that's a pretty different stimulus for your system to play Thursday night. You know, then on Sunday, are you just watching football? Are you doing something with your family? Are you, you know, whatever. Then you try to get back into it on Monday as if it's a regular week. Can be a little bit challenging of a thing for the teams that are out there. So I don't think that that's an angle that would, you know, that would point me towards 5-16 against the spread. But it is one of those examples that, you know, when you take guys out of their regular rhythm, some things can happen.
You know, Adam, I am so happy you brought this up because I misspoke to a degree. I forgot one parameter when I was going through those. And those were the Thursday night games off a home win. You play on the road and the line is between the threes against an equal opponent. The overall record, if you win on Thursdays at home and go on the road, is still a negative. It's 25-33, 43.1 against the spread. But again, against an equally matched team when the line is between the threes, then it's 5-16. My apologies for misspeaking and missing that one parameter.
Well, I'm glad you're able to correct it. But again, I mean, it is still, you know, over a relatively
43%,
strong sample size.
Yeah,
over a relatively strong sample size, it is still a losing proposition. But then again, you talk about playing teams that are your equal. That's the thing that also stands out there because, you know, is it one of those things where you kind of get that fat and happy sensation about winning on Thursday night? Because keep in mind, too, one of the things I think is important to point out here is that, generally speaking, and the NFL has done a better job of this here lately, putting some marquee games in that Thursday time slot. Generally speaking, that Thursday night game is also going to be off of a division win, which we know can be a situational angle in the NFL as well.
Well, right. This year with Fox taking over, we see the change starting this week. With the national games on Fox, Fox threw up as much money as NBC did on Sunday night, and hence we have, you know, Minnesota and the LA Rams starting this week with the NFL Network now switching over to the Fox national broadcast. So obviously with that deal became some marquee games. But you're right, the Thursday games used to be, let's just throw the two teams in that we know we have to be on national TV once that no one wants to watch, and it doesn't matter what scenario they're in, we just got to get them out of the way early in this season. So, you know, and let's remember too, I mean, you know, we talk about kids that pull huge upsets and, you know, pull it, you know, Old Dominion. I'm going to talk about Old Dominion later, but off that Old Dominion upset, what do? You party. Well, I'll tell you what, the Browns hadn't won a game in 2 years. Yes, they're professionals. Yes, Baker Mayfield was cool and collective on the TV screen, but those Browns partied. I'll tell you what, Thursday night, it was like probably a college thing, pulling the biggest upset over your rival. I don't care who you are. Every Browns player partied that night and probably partied multiple days to get that monkey off the back and get that win.
And you know what? I mean, you deserve it. And when you do it on a Thursday night, you can do that. You can party it up. You can go to practice hungover Friday or Saturday, you know, and then get back to work. So, you know, hey, good for them. It was definitely an emotional time for a lot of Browns fans out there, and, you know, got to open the fridges and drink that beer, water, piss, Bud Light stuff. But, you know, in any event, we'll see how the Browns do wind up looking here with that cross-country trip out to Oakland. All right, let's transition over to the college football side here. And, you know, we started talking about strength of schedule last week. I think it's good to bring it up here this week as well, because a lot of teams getting into conference play, maybe playing a second conference game or wrapping up the non-conference portion of the season, they won't play another non-conference game until a bowl if they're fortunate enough to get there, or maybe if they've got some sort of rivalry game. Or if you're in the SEC, you play an FCS team the week before your rivalry matchup. So strength of schedule mismatches here, Rolf. I'm sure we've got some this week that pretty much stand out.
Yeah, and you know what? We talked about it last week, Adam, and I started this week with, you know, if you go to wagertalk.com and just go to the Cal Sports Handicapping page, you're going to see a year-to-date stat difference. And what I do is I give you the team strength of schedule. I give you their plus or minus yards per game diff. A lot of people talk about who the best offense is or who the best defense is. The most important stat is how many yards per game you're plus or minus on the year. It gives you the point per game. It gives you the yards per play. It gives you the turnovers. And it gives you the plays per game. For those people that do totals, you got to know those teams that are playing 86 plays per game on offense and those teams that are playing 58 plays per game. But if you go and you download that report, you're going to see three different reports. One is alphabetically. You can find your favorite team, see what their numbers are, and compare them to who you want. The second is strength of schedule. And what you want to do with the strength of schedule is find two teams that are playing this week, and those that have equal strength of schedule, then compare the other stats, the yards per game, the points per game, see how those teams did against like opponents. The third chart is sorted by yards per game. So if you have two teams that are equal in yards per game but have a very varied strength of schedule, that's something you want to look at as well. You know, one example is Virginia Tech and Duke this week. They're playing each other. Duke is a 5-point favorite. If you look at the chart I did, Virginia Tech is plus 93 yards per game. Yes, they were off that upset loss. Duke is actually plus 94 yards per game. Well, Virginia Tech's played the 156 schedule, and Duke's played the 55 schedule. So you have two teams even. Duke has played 100 spots stronger of a schedule. Duke is only minus 5 at home. Oh, yeah, and by the way, Virginia Tech now is with their top quarterback and a defensive lineman just got booted off. So, you know, that's something where I clearly am looking at Duke in that game, and that follows that situation. You know, on the opposite end, let's look at two teams that have similar strengths of schedule. Virginia is number 84. North Carolina State is number 97. So very similar. Virginia has played 13 spots easier of a – harder of a schedule, excuse me. And Virginia is better on the year. They're plus 137 yards per game. Duke is very close to plus 132. But Virginia is also plus 1.5 yards per play, Duke 1.3. So I have the better team getting – over home field edge, they're getting six. That was a game that opened up at eight, came down through seven, and is now six. But Virginia, to me, has the edge there, playing the tougher team, having the better stats, and getting over the home field edge. So multiple ways to look at the chart, but I think it's something everyone should print off and have in front of them when they're handicapping the college football card.
Yeah, it is. And you said Duke there, but you did read off the numbers for NC State. So those were the accurate numbers there. Rolf was looking at the NC State line, just did happen to say Duke there. So those are the accurate numbers for that matchup game, 143-144. So again, you know, as you mentioned, that is a number that's come down from 8 to 6. Seems like that's a stopping point here so far. But again, some of that may be factoring into the equation here where Virginia's played a comparable schedule to NC State, but just has – had a little bit more success with it. And also, I mean, Virginia is a team that I've had to adjust up rather significantly here so far this year. Bronco Mendenhall is doing a really terrific job, Cavaliers team. But we got some requests from listeners here on some games to talk about this week. We'll see if any of these apply to strength of schedule mismatches. We'll start with game 141-142, South Carolina and Kentucky. South Carolina opened a 1-point favorite. Now Kentucky, pretty much consensus market-wide, a 1.5-point favorite here. South Carolina, very surprising, dominant win over Vanderbilt last week. Kentucky, with that win over Mississippi State, ranked in the top 25 for the first time since 2007. I think a lot of people are surprised to see this line, you know, virtually a relative pick 'em. And if you take home field advantage away, South Carolina favored on a neutral. So is that surprising to you, Rolf?
Well, you know, South Carolina, like you said, opened the favorite, and the uproar was, well, you have a ranked SEC team at home facing a non-ranked SEC team, and the team is a home dog. Obviously, that has straightened itself out. You know, on paper, clearly to me, South Carolina is the better team. You know, and their stats are skewed because they played the tougher schedule. They played Georgia. You know, you watched Kentucky last week, and yes, the Florida win was big, snapping that streak, but beating that Mississippi State team at home, you know, Benny Snell talked up a Kentucky Wildcats win all week, and he backed it up. You know, Snell with 540 yards already and 6.2 yards per carry. You know, I love the way that team gets there. But South Carolina, to me, has covered 8 straight road games, and, you know, Kentucky hasn't beaten back-to-back ranked teams. South Carolina, some people have in the ranks since 1941. It's a situation where Kentucky's a much improved team. Kentucky's getting to a bowl. Kentucky is a team to be reckoned with, but I would back South Carolina and a defense this week that, again, numbers are skewed because they allowed 473 yards to Georgia, but Georgia, one of the best offenses in the country.
Well, and this is one of those games where even if you don't feel like you have a quantifiable edge on it, and I really don't, I mean, this is about where my number is on this game. This feels like a spot where Kentucky loses. You know, when you kind of look at college football historically, you talk about teams getting into the top 25, getting that big top 15 upset at home. All of a sudden, Kentucky has expectations. And South Carolina is a program that, you know, they had some down years at the end of the Spurrier tenure, had a rebuilding year in year one under Will Muschamp a little bit. But South Carolina, over the last 10 to 15 years, has been the far more accomplished program. Now you've got this Kentucky team with expectations, probably going to be a sellout crowd in Lexington, night game. I don't know if they'll blew out the stands or whatever it is that they do there, but this feels like a game that Kentucky loses. And like I said, not quantifiable necessarily. I don't know if I'll play this angle, but this is just one of those things that, you know, from following college football or following college basketball or something like that, you just kind of get that feel. And again, maybe not actionable, but it would certainly keep me off of the Kentucky side if my power rating suggested that as a play or something like that.
Well, another thing you have to look at is you know, what South Carolina did last week against Vanderbilt, they were off a very disappointing Georgia. They were talking in Columbia that, you know, we beat Georgia, we can win the SEC division, we can go to the playoffs. So, you know, losing that one by 24 is demoralizing. But then going on the road and doing what they did to Vanderbilt, having a 250-yard edge and holding Vanderbilt to 2.8 yards per carry. The other thing to remember is this. South Carolina has lost four straight games to Kentucky. That's the type of gut punch that three of those games you were a significant favorite, including last year at home, you were a five-point favorite and lost 23-13. So I have you as the better team. Kentucky off a basically historic win. South Carolina with four-time revenge going in where they think they were the better team the last 4 years. Well, there's no looking past them this year, and I think they get that revenge.
All right, let's go to game 145-146 here. We do have a couple of lopsided lines that listeners wanted to hear about. And again, Adam at bangthebook.com via email if there are games you want to hear about, or at Skating Tripods on Twitter. Game 145-146, Indiana and Rutgers. Indiana up from 15 to 17.5 here. Not really a big surprise to see this move, Rolf. Is there any way that you can take Rutgers in this situation?
Well, yes. It's ugly. They won't be on my card. But I just think that you're putting Indiana in a situation off a physical Michigan State game that you're in a role that you're not accustomed to, being a 17-point favorite. You know, you have to win by three scores. Last year, if you look on the road, you know, last year they went to Purdue, they lost. They went to Illinois, they won by 10. And they went to Virginia early and won. They got outgained, but they won that game by 17. So they haven't won a game by 17 on the road. It's a situation that I look at and say, well, you have a Big Ten game. You're off a physical Big Ten game. And just because you're the better team by that many points in the power ratings, and to me, it's a different scenario going on the road and winning by three scores. So, you know, Rutgers isn't Maryland where they had, you know, a bunch of scenarios happen and they went through changes. They still have the same coaching staff. Yes, their quarterback got knocked out against Ohio State. He came back last week, was ineffective. But now they're back at home, and it's just a situation that while I don't want to back Rutgers off losses to Ohio State, Kansas, and Buffalo, but I just don't like the situation Indiana's in. And that's the thing you have to look at. When the teams are improving and then they start going on the road, you got to learn to win on the road and then learn to cover on the road. I mean, I say it often, and this isn't a situation I would want to back the Hoosiers.
Well, that's the thing, too. I mean, you know, the spread, and this is obvious to say, but the spread is the great equalizer. I mean, there's a handicap involved here that suggests that Rutgers is 17.5 points worse than Indiana based on the market. And that means that Indiana has to go out there and not just win this game, but dominate this game. Now, can they do it? Sure, they probably could. But you look at Rutgers here and, you know, I mean, they don't have any delusions of grandeur about going to a bowl game or anything like that. What does that game last week against Buffalo mean to them? Not a damn thing. This at least is a conference game. This is at least one where you want to show up, play a little bit better. As you mentioned, you know, they're at home getting a big number. Yeah, Rutgers is terrible. Yeah, Rutgers is a team that I will not have on my card this week, and it'll be hard to take them any week the rest of the way. But that doesn't mean that you have to take Indiana, because this is a high set of expectations for an Indiana team that's really not particularly good. I mean, I faded them last week with Michigan State. They were on my gold nugget card. Thought it was a good spot for Sparty. But also, you know, Indiana's body of work hadn't impressed me that much. They fall flat in that game last week. Is there a hangover this week where they feel like they can walk in here, win this game comfortably? You know, just because a team is really bad like Rutgers doesn't mean you have to bet against them.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those plug-your-nose games. And, again, this isn't a game I'm going to be on, but, you know, you look at Indiana this year, you got to remember, they played three straight home games against Virginia, Ball State, Michigan State. Yeah, I mean, you know, they beat Ball State, and they covered against Virginia as a five-point favorite, but they were a 10- to 12-point favorite at FIU earlier this year to start the season, and they didn't cover. Well, FIU's probably a few points better than Rutgers, But now you're putting the same scenario on with Indiana playing back-to-back conference games and Rutgers not off a conference game, like you said. The situation, to me, means the spread should be less than it was against FIU in respect to the Rutgers situation. I made this line 15. Again, so we're not talking huge points of value, but again, if I had to pick a side, it's a side that I would back Rutgers, not because I like Rutgers, because I don't like the situation IU's in.
Yeah, this game's also 15 for me, so I was right on the opener there, and you know, maybe some perception bias kind of driving this thing up a little bit to 17.5. Speaking of lines that are 17.5, game 153-154, BYU on the road in Seattle to take on Washington. The Huskies have to cover a big number here, Rolf.
Yeah, and it's another situation. You know, we talked about BYU, and, you know, we don't know if BYU's wins at Arizona and Wisconsin were great, or both of those teams are down a little bit. Well, you know, if you have one win on the season against a Power 5 team when you're a dog, you know, you're not really sure. But when you can pull wins against Arizona and Wisconsin, you know, I think it means a little bit more. And then in between there, they were at home against Cal. They did get outgained by 110 yards or 111 yards, and they lost that game. So right now their preferred situation is being on the road. You know, you have a team where BYU can slow the rush attack, and it's in the line. I mean, BYU is a 17-point dog, and you have a total of 44. So what I like to do is break down these games. Let's take the point spread off the total. 44 minus 17 is 27. Divide that in half, it's 13.5 points. So they're telling you that BYU is going to score 13.5, and Washington is going to score Washington's going to score 30.5. So in a correlated parlay, you're looking at that, and I break every game down like that, and I'm saying, well, do I think BYU can get the 14? I do. Washington's defense allowed 20 to Arizona State last week, and they allowed 21 to Auburn. Yes, they have a very good defense, but they haven't faced the rush attack that BYU can give them. You know, Squally Canada, 392 yards, 5.3. They have Lopina Kaota, who's averaging 5.6 yards per carry. The team as a whole is averaging 4.3, and that was with a bad performance against Cal. I think their run game can slow the game down enough. I think you have a situation with Washington, again, they're off two Pac-12 games, then they play the rest of their conference schedule. They're off a win against Arizona State. They have UCLA on deck. They have back-to-back road games. To me, it's a game that Washington wins. I think it's going to be a lower-scoring game. And anytime that happens, and I have an offense that can run the ball, a defense that can keep me in the game, I think the 17 points is well worth taking.
This is a tough one for me because I feel like I want to take BYU here for a lot of the same reasons that you mentioned. I'm not sure what Washington is at this point. You know, I mean, that game against Auburn to open the season was very, very strange. It looked like in the first half, Auburn was going to take them to the woodshed. Then all of a sudden, Auburn started making mistakes. Washington got back in that game, could very well have won that game. Then they beat North Dakota, win on the road at Utah. I don't know how good of a team Utah is, and I don't know how good of a team Arizona State is. And that game was a little too close for comfort last week. So I don't know what Washington is. And Washington is a team that, you know, right now I've got them power rated easily in my top 10. You know, they're a team that was top 5 basically for me coming into the year. They're 8th now for me, but I also feel like they're a team that I'm starting to want to sell my stock in because I don't know how good they are. I think defensively they are good. I think Jake Browning has regressed as a quarterback here over the last couple of years. Their reliance on the running game and Myles Gaskin concerns me when it comes to trying to cover big numbers. I think Washington is a stock that I want to sell. I just don't know if I want to sell it yet this week.
Well, you know, you talk about Browning, and, I mean, you're so correct. Last year he had a 19-5 ratio, completing 69%. This year he's completing 61% with a 7-4 ratio, so 5 INTs all last year, 4 INTs already this season. And you look at Gaskins, well, if Jake Browning can't throw the ball deep, then the rush lanes are smaller for Gaskins. Gaskins last year at 1,380 yards, 6.2 yards per carry. This year he's at 4.3 yards per carry. So the dynamics of that offense have clearly come back towards the median. Yes, they're still a good offense, and yes, they have one of the best defenses in the country, and yes, they have the best secondary in the country. They're holding their opponents under 60%, and they've played some decent offenses, you know, including Auburn, Arizona State, and Utah. I mean, again, very difficult schedule to start. But BYU's not trying to pass the ball. Tyler Magnum, you know, only has thrown the ball 116 times in four games, so he's thrown the ball under 30 times a game. And they're rushing the ball on average almost 40 times. So Washington's strengths here aren't what BYU wants to do, and that's one of the matchup edges I like the Cougars.
All right, let's go to another game that projects to be a potential blowout here again, this one per listener request, game 189-190, Oklahoma State on the road against Kansas. Oklahoma State, phenomenal performance against Boise State, not so much last week against Texas Tech. Kansas, couple wins, maybe a couple more than people expected here on the season. All their season win total was, I think, 3.5. So it's basically a prop bet of will Kansas win a conference game, yes or no, because we expected them to beat Nicholls State, Central Michigan, and the other team that they played, the Rutgers. So, you know, when you look at this game here, Rolf, I mean, 18's a pretty healthy number here for an 11 a.m. kickoff, isn't it?
It is, but it's a situation where I think I would favor the Cowboys. You know, you have to look at Kansas and what has Kansas done. Well, I think we talked about it here on the show. They beat Central Michigan and they beat Rutgers by 24 and 41 points. Well, the reason they beat them was because they were plus six turnovers in both games. Plus six turnovers probably only happens once or twice in college football a year. To be plus six turnovers in back-to-back games, the database goes back to 1999, 19 seasons. No college football team was ever plus four turnovers in back-to-back games, and Kansas was plus six. That shows how historic those wins were. Anyone's going to win plus six turnovers. But then they went to Baylor. They did what I expected. They got outgained by 176 yards. They only had 14 first downs, and they only put up 7 points. So to me, you have that same situation now. They're back at home, and you have to me, completely ignore those two games. So what has Kansas done on the season? Well, they were at home. They lost to Nicholls State 26-23, and that wasn't a fluke. Nicholls State outgained them by 74 yards. They go to Baylor, not a good Baylor team, and they got outgained by 176 yards. Now they face an Oklahoma State team that's off a rare home loss, who gave up 621 yards to Texas Tech, 224 rushing, 397 yards passing, one of the worst losses in Gundy's career. And now they're going to take revenge. And Gundy is a team that when he's a favorite, he is not afraid to run up the score. So I think you have an angry Cowboys team, a Kansas team that people have overvalued because of what happened. I would lay the points with the Cowboys.
Yeah, I think that's the only way to go here, too. I actually grabbed 16 on the Bet Online opener, so I'm happy to be below 17 here. My number is 19.5, but this was a game where the line was only going in one direction because you've got Oklahoma State in a bounce-back spot. Kansas was a paper tiger with those two upsets, as you mentioned, with that turnover margin. So I think Oklahoma State can name the score here. The obvious concern is what score do they want to name, but I think they want to get some confidence back going here. And Kansas, always a good team for getting confidence going out there in the Big 12. One more game here to break down in depth, then we'll have a couple of free picks from Rolf at the end of the segment here. Game 207-208, Stanford and Notre Dame. Notre Dame up from 3.5 to 5.5 or 6 here. The Ian Book factor definitely playing a role in this line move.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm usually not one to jump on the bandwagon after one appearance because, you know, while Brian Kelly came out on Friday and he said, yes, we're going to play Wimbush and Book. So, you know, how much prep time did Wake Forest really have for that change in offense? You know, once Book started off the way he did, he just stayed with Book the entire time. So that's usually a situation where I will look to fade that Notre Dame team, but I can't because I think they have the edge. Stanford, again, off that huge Oregon overtime comeback. They have Utah on deck. They're making a second straight road start going across country. You have a team that's been home in Notre Dame three of the first 4 weeks. They made the trip to Wake Forest and they're back. You have a team that on paper, you know, the rush attack is solid. Wimbush 55% with a 1-4 ratio. Well, if you don't turn that ball over and you have a negative 3 turnover ratio your first three games, your defense all of a sudden isn't on the field as much. You're not giving up as many yards as you did against Vanderbilt, giving up 420 yards. That's their worst performance. You know, but they did hold Wake Forest to 398, a very good and quick-paced Wake Forest team. Because of this situation, because K.J. Costello, yes, he's got a 10-3 ratio, but Bryce Love, he's not taking advantage of what he's been given. People are still filling the boxes. Bryce Love is only averaging 4.3 yards per carry, and Stanford's averaging 3.7 yards per carry on the season. Well, Notre Dame's only allowing 3.5 yards per carry on their defensive side. To me, the matchup favors Notre Dame. I'm going to buy into the book boost they're going to get with his first home start and back the Irish.
My power ratings have a pretty clear edge to me here in this spot for Stanford. My number is more like 1.5, 2 here. Maybe I didn't adjust Notre Dame up enough with book. I did make an adjustment for them, kind of bouncing them back up a little bit. But it's very hard for me to take Stanford here. You know, I mean, I think David Shaw is a pretty good coach. I don't think Brian Kelly is a very good coach. And in fact, as we're talking here, this number getting hit down from 5.5 or 6 down to 5. So we are seeing Stanford money hit the board here right now as we're recording the show. It's just hard for me to make that leap because, as you mentioned, this is a conference sandwich spot for Stanford. And while this is a premier game, and this is kind of a rivalry for them since these two teams play every year, this is a long trip out to South Bend. When you just started your conference season, when you had that big game in the Pac-12 North, it's a tricky spot for Stanford to stay the least. So while I think this is a great game to watch, I don't think at the current number there's a whole lot of reason to fly into this game. But like I said, from a power rating standpoint, it would be Stanford or nothing here for me. So, Rolf, with that, we're not going to do the pick six segment here this week. I guess I kind of threw you into the fire a little bit with that as you're still adjusting your numbers and, you know, breaking down all the different angles in the game. So instead of that, we're going to look at Rolf's favorite situational and technical plays of the week. So let's go ahead and start with the situational, Rolf.
Yeah, just to give people an idea, you know, when we used to be on Thursdays, it was no problem. I had all my prep work done. But I'm one that doesn't go through prep work in increments. I don't do my power ratings. I don't do my situations. I do team by team. So for me, by Tuesday morning, I'm not caught up with every game yet. And I don't want to give an opinion that's half-assed or that I really haven't looked at. So, you know, hence in lieu of the pick six, my favorite technical situation is playing San Jose as a home dog this week. And why? Because I'm fading Hawaii. Again, how many times am I going to say you got to learn to win on the road before you learn to win to cover? Hawaii is 1-13 ATS, their last 14 games as a favorite. And that cover came against Western Carolina, an FCS team. Hawaii is 0-7 as an away favorite since 2011. That's 8 years. They've only been an away favorite 7 times. You look at, yes, they won at Colorado State, and then they lost at Army. This is their third trip to the mainland. San Jose State, 4-0 ATS as a dog, their last 5. I'm going to fade Hawaii. Again, I think Hawaii wins the game, but covering at this line, I'll back San Jose State at home.
On San Jose State, I mean, they might be an improving team. UC Davis kind of gave Stanford a game, although it was a weird spot for Stanford that they weren't too invested in. San Jose State did lose to them in the opener, but they were a big dog in that game, too. I think the line was 10.5 or something like that. It was a crazy FCS versus FBS number. Covered against Wazoo, covered against Oregon. Wazoo and Oregon not in great spots there. Neither is Hawaii, coming back to the mainland once again, as you mentioned. And this is a number that shot up. It's from 8.5 to as high as 13 out there now in the market. So you're looking at San Jose State in that one. How about your situational play for this week?
Well, you know, it doesn't get any bigger situation than Old Dominion with their upset last week. And, you know, this week they got to East Carolina, and I am going to fade Old Dominion and back East Carolina. East Carolina is another team that a lot of people had as low as anyone as far as their power ratings go. But to me, they're a team that you look at them on paper, they're clearly improving. They're improving by over 200 yards per game and over 20 points per game from last year's numbers. Listen, this defense, yes, they played North Carolina AT&T to open, but they played North Carolina and USF, two offenses that most people would rank in their top 30 or 40. Well, they're only allowing 320 yards per game and 14 first downs per game. They held USF on the road to 9 first downs last week. This is a greatly improved Pirates team. They're plus 115 yards per game, being 1-2. To me, again, now you have Old Dominion in a dog situation, bouncing back. You're probably laying 3 or 4 points more than you should because of the upset. That was their first win of the year. This is the same Old Dominion team that went to Liberty, got outgained by 290 yards, lost to FIU at home, got outgained by 93 yards, went to Charlotte, got outgained by 35 yards. You have to look at the season as a whole. You have to look that they're back on the road now, and East Carolina wins this game handily.
Rolf Michaels, professional handicapper from WagerTalk.com. What do you got going on over there right now, Rolf?
Well, again, the new stat report is up. Every Monday now, you can also get the Gridiron Guide. It's a full page per college matchup. It has your stats. You know, check out those misleading stats. Was your team a plus a lot of turnovers? Did you get outgained and won the game because of that? And then it also has situations as ATS and over-unders. You have my new ATS, you have my new year-to-date stat matchup. All of that's free. WagerTalk.com. Go to the Handicappers tab on top. Go to the Cal Sports page, and they're all free downloads. Adam, I got a question for you. I know that you are infamous because I think it was a Cy Young pitcher who said you have a great Twitter handle. And for those that don't know and follow Adam on Twitter, I'm sure you all do. I never heard the story how you got your Twitter handle.
All right. So Corey Kluber actually mentioned it. The Indians did a mean tweets thing with their previous social media guy. And it was something that went over very well. And, you know, you wound up saying that I have a great Twitter handle. So at Skating Tripods is the beer league hockey team that I used to play for. We've been defunct for about 6 or 7 years now, I would say. But that's the team I used to play for, was the Skating Tripods. We had these bright yellow jerseys. Our logo was the Shocker. A lot of great times getting drunk with those morons. And, you know, I do miss it a lot, but at least the name lives on with my Twitter handle.
Awesome, awesome. College football off to a great start. 4 weeks, 4 winning weeks, 16-8. All my plays at WagerTalk.com.
And you can follow Rolf on Twitter, at CalSportsLV. Rolf Michaels, appreciate your time as always, sir. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Adam.
Good stuff there on today's program with Rolf Michaels, professional handicapper over at WagerTalk.com. Coming up on our Wednesday edition of Bang the Book Radio, we'll be joined by another handicapper from WagerTalk. That is Brian Leonard. We'll chat NFL and college football with him. Then we'll chat with Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds, the number one on Twitter. Probably take a look at some derivative betting for the NFL and college football here this week. And also take another look at the Ryder Cup. Thursday, Brad Powers and Tony George. Friday, Westgate Super Contest Selection segment and Brent from DSI Sportsbook. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And I will talk to you again tomorrow.